All right, good morning. Hope things are well. Let's see. So my thought for today was to try a little bit more with writing up, but this time I thought I'd try indicating how I might write up some of the problems that we've already discussed the techniques for, so we already have some idea how to approach them. But now just how I might write that up, and then see whether people have thoughts or comments about that, other approaches, or things that they might have added or left out. And then I also have some problems on metric spaces that I worked out. The other thing I've added here to this web page, one of the secretaries did get back to me with at least some of the past passing scores, so you have at least some idea what was required. Yeah, apparently the data is hidden in our various files, but has not been compiled anywhere that anyone knows previously, so it's going to take a while to get it all together. But at least we have a few of the last few years, which I guess is probably the most relevant anyway. Okay, and let's see. So beyond that, I guess we can go back and look briefly at the problems we were looking at last time in case people had other thoughts that since yesterday, and then run through and examine then, as I said, try some write-ups. Okay, and feel free to comment if you have any thoughts. All right, so let me just look at the ones that we were looking at last time. Okay, yeah, so oh, yeah, so this is one we looked at some length and tried to get a write-up, and I would like to come back to this one and do a detailed write-up. But let me, oops, suddenly it doesn't work. Yeah, all right, so lots of power to write. Anyway, yeah, so I'll come back and do a detailed write-up of this one after we look at the exam. So unless there are immediate comments, I will return to this one. Okay. All right, and so the next one. All right, so did anyone have further thoughts about this? We had a basic idea for this one, this method of using Weierstrass combined with a diagonalization type argument, and then a fact that while derivatives are wild, integrals are nicely smoothing, so you can go backwards. Okay. All right, so then, the next one, let's see, so for this one, I'm having a little trouble with my pad while I'm doing this. Yes, this one we had, I think, pretty cleanly, and that's a good one, I think, to write up because it's once you have the idea, then it's not too bad to actually write up the details in a clear way. All right, and we did work out the idea last time. Let's see, this one. So I forget how much we said about this, but this is closely related to some of the other problems that we've looked at where we have integral operators, and we try to understand the spectrum of those. All right. Oh, I don't think we looked at that one. But here's one that we did, and this one, again, we worked out the idea, and I think maybe I will also come back to this one and try to write up this one in a detailed way also, although we came pretty close last time, but it's nice just to practice how to write it up. And here's another one that turned out there was kind of an algebraic approach which we worked out. Okay, so that was just a very quick summary of my memory of how we saw what the problems that we looked at last time. So do anyone have any thoughts about that? Okay, so let's see. So as I suggested, I wanted to look over an old exam and then look at some write-ups. Hopefully I'll have my pad working by then. So let's start with an exam and okay, and let me try to get it all on the screen. Okay, let's see. And of course, it's a link from the web page, or there's a link in the chat box. And unfortunately, since my pad is, I'll try to get my pad running while you look at this for a couple of minutes. Okay, let's see if people get a chance to read through these. Want another minute? Okay, how about one more minute, and then we'll see what thoughts people have had about these problems. Okay, let's look these over. So actually, let me try unsharing and then sharing to see if that makes this. I'm seeing some residue from the other one that doesn't seem to go away. So if I can fix that. Yeah, seems to do it. Okay, so. Okay, so do people have thoughts about this first one? And it's the sort of thing you should expect, right? So A is an you should know examples of this, and then B is a standard lemma that you'd find in a text and one that you would be good to review. Okay. Any other thoughts or comments about that one? Okay, what about the second one? Well, so it tells you what to do, right? Because it tells you to state the approximation theorem and then try to use it. So notice that this is different from the problem we did last time where we had this integral on a short space being zero, but we found examples where the function itself was not zero. So that one's kind of fun to think through. Actually, can anyone see what's going to happen if we tried the same method that we used on that problem here? So remember on that other problem, we took a Fourier transform and observed that we could find functions for which this failed. So what's going to happen here? Can anyone see that? Yeah, that's right. We end up showing that the polynomials are dense. Yeah. And you remember what was different on the problem that we looked at yesterday? Because there we also had the integral against the polynomials vanishing, but it wasn't sufficient. All right, so that was the case where we were working on all of R instead of just 0, 1. Right. And so in this case, the Fourier transform is going to be discrete, and you're not going to have the same counterexamples. Right. Yeah, it does, exactly. And that's exactly right. And this is demonstrating that, right? Because in one case it works and the other didn't. Right. Okay, any other thoughts or comments about this one? Does that one look fairly straightforward? These hands are greens, I suppose. Yeah, I think it does. It's remembering that theorem. Okay, what about 3? So this is a computation that we did last time in another problem, which is very similar, and therefore one that probably makes sense to do. Actually, I think I may run through that one again as an example of something to write up. Okay. Okay, so here they actually tell you the definition and then do the proof. And then you need some examples. And what are typical examples for this one? So these are things that converge weakly, but not strongly. Yeah, exactly. And that's just one you should always have just to throw at things. And that's going to work here. Right. Okay, what about this next one, number 4 here? Yeah, you can just compute that these things are projections because you know the things you have to check. Yeah, and for B, actually, yeah, what is the spectrum of something like this T going to have to be? How restrictive are these two conditions? Can Sandra see that? I mean, so let's just look at the second one. So the condition that T squared be equal to minus the identity, how much can you just read off immediately about the spectrum from that formula? Certainly it's on the unit circle, right? I claim you can do better than that. You can even be more restrictive. Yeah, it's written there. Yep. Plus or minus I, that's right. Right, and one, I'm not sure how you saw that. There's more than one way, but one way is to think of the functional calculus. Here we have plugged our operator into some function, a very simple function, x squared, and that's going to plug the spectrum in also. So so we have the spectrum of t squared should be the same as the square of the spectrum. Right, so the spectrum should behave well with respect to this functional calculus. Right, so we're just going to get that plus or minus I, and so then the question is, oh, that is what you meant. I see, I got it. All right, very good. That's right, that's exactly right. Okay. Yes. Very good, yeah, okay, you're right. Okay, yeah, that's right. So that tells us pretty much everything about this operator. So any other thoughts or comments about this one? Okay. So number five. Right. Okay, and just to get our hands on what's going on, so first of all, this is a Fourier transform problem, right? And when you're thinking about Fourier transforms, how should that integral typically be interpreted? Exactly. So this is going to be f hat of 0, right? Okay, and does anyone remember what this hint means, what the Riemann-Lebesgue lemma gives us? So there are various maps, right? So if you take the Fourier transform, it takes Schwarz space back to itself, it takes L2 to itself, Right, next is Poincaré fact. But what does it do to L1? Yeah. And it's that zero that's key, and this is the Riemann-Lebesgue. Okay. Right, and so that says something is vanishing, and we want something to vanish, so it makes sense that those two would be related. Okay, any other thoughts or comments about this one? I guess as long as I'm making this little list, the other important one, of course, is the dual space of the Schwartz, which is also taken to itself. Okay, other thoughts. All right, then, what about this last one, number six? Yeah, it's logical computing. There's a name for this. What kind of a problem would you call that? Yeah, it's a fundamental solution or a Green's function. Right. Yeah. Okay, very good. So, any other thoughts or comments about this exam? All right, so then as I advertised, but my thoughts were to do next was to try looking at a couple of write-ups to try to figure out how we would write down some of the ideas that we came up with last time in the previous ones. And I don't know, we can see how many of those hold people's interest. And then I have some metric space problems assembled also, so we can look at those. All right. So maybe then we could just start with one of the problems that I think we looked at last time. So the one that I had in mind, let's see, actually I kind of thought, so there was one we were talking about last time that I promised I'd come back to twice now, and I will. So, but as a warm up for that one, I think it makes sense to look at spring 15 number 4. So let's do that. So I think that one is here. Yeah, so spring 15 number 4. Okay, so we want to show, well, you can read it, but I can also make it bigger. Okay, so we have these measurable functions, and the integrals are all bounded by the L2 norms are all bounded by 1, and it goes to 0 almost everywhere. And we want to show that the 1 norm, that the integral itself, is going to 0. Okay, actually, let me put this on the other screen where I have more control. Okay, let's see. So so the problem here, let me just rewrite it here so that we have it. So this is a spring 2015 number 4. And we have these Fn, which map the interval to R, measurable functions. And we have the two conditions that the two norm is bounded for all of them, and they approach zero almost everywhere. Okay, and then we want to show that the integrals are approaching zero. And so let's see. So let me do my own attempt at a write-up and then see whether people have comments or thoughts about how one might change this or do it differently. So write-up. Okay, so first of all, do people remember how what the idea is here? Right, this is an Egoroff problem, right? So so let's try that. So choose by Egoroff's theorem. So what we have is that for every epsilon greater than zero, we have a set E epsilon contained in our interval I. Let me just give that 0, 1 a shorter name I, which is, I think, a handy way to do it, with the measure of E most of I, all but epsilon of I, and Fn restricted to this set approaching zero uniformly. Okay. So in other words, for all mu, there exists some constant n indexed by the mu and the epsilon, so that whenever I take a k bigger than this n, and x in E epsilon, we have, we wanted that F K of X has norm less than mu, all right? And so then we can note that if we have a large N or K here, if K is bigger than this N, mu epsilon, then we have the norm of the absolute value of this integral that we care about, 0, 1, f, k of x dx. We just split it up into the integral on e epsilon and the integral off E epsilon and then that gives us a bound by mu for the first one and the one norm of Fn restricted to the complement okay and so then we get mu plus so now here I would put the method we're using. This is the holder. So then we get this is bounded by Fn 2 and the characteristic function on I minus E epsilon 2. And then we're done. So this is then less than or equal to mu plus root epsilon. And then just to finish it up, I would write the following. So for all tau, we can, greater than zero, we can just choose mu equals tau over two, and epsilon equals tau squared over four. And we get for all n bigger than this capital NU epsilon, we have the absolute value of the integral from 0 to 1 of f sub n of x dx is less than tau. So that's how I would write it up. Anyone have any thoughts or comments about that? Is that... Does that have the amount of detail that you would have imagined? Okay. All right, so that's one that we've worked through completely. So if there are no further comments about that, then let me go to the one that we didn't finish, but is also a more complicated Egorov problem, spring 14 number 3, okay? Which I think, let's see, I think that it's on my... Yeah, there it is. Okay, so this is one that we looked at last time, let's see, has anyone had any further thoughts about this one since we last looked at it? Okay, maybe I'll just draw a picture of my thoughts for how to approach it, and then again we can try, I can try running through my thoughts for how I would write it up, and I'd be happy to have comments about how you might do it differently. Okay, so here's one picture for how you might approach this. Okay, and maybe I'll just, as I said, draw a picture and then switch to the other board to write things up. So, of course, so first of all, the other one had several things going for it that this one doesn't, right? So what's the biggest problem with using Egorov here? Yeah, we don't have a finite measure space. We have to somehow find a finite measure space. So we need a finite measure space. Okay, so here's one idea for how to find a finite measure space that's associated with it. So if we have our function f, Okay, and we have our domain, let's say omega in this example is the positive reals. So it's not compact, so that's the kind of issue that we have. All right, and so, and it's not finite, actually. I guess that's really what we care about. It's not a finite measure space, an infinite measure. So here's one approach. We can cut it off at the values of f. So I can take this set here. A sub epsilon to be F inverse of, say, epsilon up to epsilon inverse. Okay, so this is going to be a finite measure space. Since the integral of f is finite. Okay, and it's bigger than the measure of A times epsilon. Right. Okay, so that's one way to get a finite measure space to work in. And I can choose this epsilon, this A, to be big enough that this has small area. Okay, so I can choose epsilon with the integral of in A complement of my f less than, say, alpha.
Are we guaranteed that the integral of f is finite?
That is a good question. That is how I would have interpreted this, but you're saying I could have interpreted it as saying, as including the value infinity.
Yeah.
And oh no, it does say Lebesgue integrable. Yeah. Okay.
So. Okay. So it's L1.
Yeah. So this is, yeah, that's right. So this should be in r greater than zero. Yes. Other comments or questions? Okay, so so we have this small measure here. Alpha. Okay, and so now we have a finite measure space, so then we can start using Egoroff, right? And so I can find this smaller set here. Maybe this is my E associated to the epsilon and some beta. Okay, and so then the complement of this E is going to be have measure less than beta. Okay, and so then I have a bound on the area here because I have a bound on this height, which I forgot to write in, but it's in the formulas. So right, this goes from epsilon at the bottom here to epsilon inverse at the top. So this green area has a bound of epsilon inverse times beta. Okay, and then we're going to get this the approximation that we want. So we have our function here, which would be our fn, okay? And then we're trying to get that the difference between f, the black one, and the blue one, fn, is small. We know the total integrals are similar, but that's going to be adding and subtracting. And we want to know that the L1 norm of their difference is small. So in other words, that we add both the top, the bits where it's bigger and smaller. So that's the goal. Okay, so that's the idea. Any comments or thoughts? Is that clear? So that's the idea I want to take and turn into a write-up. Okay, so let me do that. Let me do that on the other board where I have more power. Actually, I did use the term compact at some point, which is actually irrelevant to this picture. This is a measure theory, so the only thing that matters is that it's a finite measure space. That's what we need. Right. And it's going to be finite because we cut this, we cut it down to make it finite. Okay, any other comments or questions about this approach? No? All right, so then let me switch boards and try writing out how I would try to write this out in a clear way, a somewhat clear way. So all right, so this is an attempt at Spring 14 problem 3. Okay, and let me just write it again. So we have F and F K are mapping omega to the positive reals. And these are Lebesgue integrable. Okay, with omega contained in Rn, and actually I'm not going to use it, but you might as well just think of it as omega equal to Rn. It doesn't really matter much. Okay, and we know that the Fk converges to F pointwise almost everywhere. All right. And we want to, two, that the integrals converge. So the integral of Fk over omega converges to the integral of F. Okay, and so we want to show that the that they converge in L1, so that F K minus F go to zero. All right, so that's the statement of the problem. Right. Okay, and so we can try to take the idea that I just sketched and write it up. And I'm going to try to do it in a way similar to the way that I wrote up the other Egoroff one. So I'm just going to keep a lot of parameters around and then choose them at the end. All right. So let's do that. Right. Actually, let me just get my notation to agree. Right. So so write just as I did on the previous board. A sub epsilon. For F inverse of epsilon to epsilon inverse. And just for notational convenience, I'll write the AC for my set omega minus A and little a for the measure. Okay, and so note, the measure of A is finite. Since this integral of F is a is finite and is bigger than or equal to epsilon times a epsilon. Sorry. Actually, let me not quite write it that way. I've already introduced a notation that's shorter. I should continue to use my notation, right? Like so. Okay. Right. So that's one thing that I would note. And so then we can apply Egorov. Oh, actually, but before that, let me choose one other thing. So just get the order correct. So choose. All right, so now I want to choose these A's so that I have only epsilon noise outside of A. So choose for all alpha greater than zero. There exists epsilon greater than zero with the integral of my function f on the complement a epsilon complement less than alpha. Okay. And so this is something that there's a sort of a question how much justification you might want to add there. One thing I might do is just kind of leave that and come back to it if I had time, or otherwise just leave it as an assertion that I can do that. All right, and so then okay, and let's see. I guess the other thing that I want is choose. So I'm going to use this number two. Oops. This number two here that tells me that I have convergence. So just choose choose a bound for that k. Just so I have it in hand. Choose for all beta greater than zero. There's some n. So that whenever I take k bigger than n, we have that this integral is less than beta. So the integral of fk minus the integral of f is at most beta. Okay, so that's the other thing that we have. All right, and let's see. So then, right. So now I've made use of this two fact and turned it into some number, and I've restricted to this small set. Okay, so then next I want to use Egorov. On this A epsilon. So, and that says we can choose for all delta. And epsilon, I can choose a set E, like I drew in the picture, which is indexed by this gamma. And actually, let me actually go back and do it all the way with the alpha. So I'm going to agree with this choice of alpha here. So an alpha, then I have an E alpha contained in A alpha. Oh, sorry. Nope. I want to agree with my indexing. So it's confusing if I don't. So let me agree with my indexing. So the way I indexed it before was with an epsilon. So I'll use an epsilon. Okay. So now my indexing agrees. Okay. And So with so just from Egoroff, of course, we have a small measure. So mu of E is less than gamma. And we have this uniform convergence. So maybe I can just put that in. So that says that for all delta, there exists some M, which is indexed by the gamma, epsilon, and delta. So that whenever I take k bigger than this, and x in this E, we have that f k of x and f differ by at most delta. Okay, so there's a lot of quantifiers, but that's the precise statement. Does that make sense? Okay, and so then we can, I think we're in a position now to just compute. Right, so compute. So if k is bigger than m gamma, and let me take the epsilon associated to alpha that I had over here. From over here, epsilon alpha, and delta. And it's also bigger than n beta, then we can just compute. So we get a bound on the measure of fk on our E. Okay, and what we get is that most of its measure is there. So there's not much that's escaped outside of our E. So let's see, so it's bigger than the integral of the function F on this set, minus the amount that it differs by F, which is a delta times the size on which we're measuring it, which is smaller than this A epsilon. Okay, and so then that's bigger than or equal to, let's see, so we have the integral over this smaller set A, and it's a bigger set, sorry, A epsilon of F. And then that differs at most by the size of the difference between E and A, which is just this gamma, times the largest value it can have, which is 1 over epsilon.
Isn't that inequality backwards? Because if we're integrating over a larger set, mm-hmm. we're not guaranteed that the value will be less than. It's the other way around.
I'm going to write it backward. Let's see. So,
right, the integral of f over e gamma epsilon will be less than or equal to the integral over a epsilon because you have the inclusion e gamma epsilon subset of a epsilon.
Oh, right. So, so what I'm writing here is that this is the most by which it could be smaller.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Yeah, so this comes from the first term, and then I'm just going to leave the second term alone. Like that. Okay, and then we can further bound this Yeah, let's see. So this first one, then, we have the full integral of f, and then the most it can differ by is this epsilon, alpha, right? That came from over here. All right, and then the rest I'm just going to leave alone. And I guess it wouldn't hurt to have labeled some of these things. So if I were to label, say, this equation 1 over here, then I could put a 1 here. And similarly, I could have labeled some of the others. I probably should have labeled a few more. Okay, so that gives us a bound. All right, and so then hence, the amount of weight that slipped outside of this is bounded. So the integral of on the complement of this gamma epsilon e of f k dx is bounded above now. Okay, and so it's going to be the integral on the entire omega of fk minus the integral on e. Actually, this, I guess, is an inequality. Let's write it that way. No need to use inequality when it's actually equal. Right, minus the integral on e of fk. And I just got a bound on the second term. So this is less than or equal to, let's see, I guess there's a beta. Let's see, where did beta come from? So beta comes from this equation here. So that gives me a beta and a alpha. Okay, and then yeah. So now I'm just now I just have these terms here. Okay, except the sign changed. So alpha and a gamma over epsilon and a delta times a epsilon. Okay, and similarly, I can bound the amount of mass that slips outside of my E on F itself. Actually, that one's easier. And it's just going to involve the middle two terms. So it's going to be less than or equal to this alpha plus gamma over epsilon. Okay, and then we're essentially done. So combining we get for all k bigger than the two things that we had over here. So M gamma epsilon sub alpha and delta and beta, just copying what we had over there. We have that the integral that we care about, so the difference in one norm between these two things, is bounded by this difference. So it's bounded by the integral over E, which is the one that we have the most control over, right? Because of the uniform convergence there, plus this noise term, which we don't have as much control over, but we can bound it by the integral over the complement of both of them, and maybe they do the worst possible thing, but we can just take the integral over the complement of their sum, so that's the worst it could be. And then we have bound for all of those. So this is then less than or equal to, so just combining the bound that we have for f and the bound that we have for fk, and the bound for the difference, where did that go, this this gamma here, we get two copies of a sub epsilon alpha times delta plus 2 gamma over epsilon alpha plus 2 alpha plus beta. So you get this kind of a mess, but that's what you get. And then you just have to do what we did at the end of the last problem and summarize what you have. So hence, for all tau, choose. And now you just have to choose everything so that this is at most tau. And I guess there's 2, 4, 6, 7 of them. So let's just put it into 7 parts. And so we have epsilon equals, the alpha is equal to, we can make it as small as we like, and we'll make it tau over 7. And then the beta we can choose as small as we like, so we'll make this also tau over 7. And then the gamma we can choose as small as we like, so we'll make it tau times epsilon sub alpha, so that's going to be sub tau over 7. It's kind of an unfortunate notation, divided by 7. And then finally, this delta will be, again, as small as we like, and we can take it to be tau divided by 7 times the area of this epsilon sub tau over 7. So the triple subscript is maybe an unfortunate choice of notation, but there we go. And the integral that we care about, this difference in one norm, is less than tau. Okay, so that's one way to write it up. So any thoughts or comments about that way to write it? So it's certainly not the only approach, but as you can see, what I did was I just threw in constants wherever I had the opportunity to, and then just summarized it all at the end. You could make it look more opaque and sleek looking at the end by choosing all the constants so that they agree with these ending ones way at the beginning, but that just does make it more opaque. Right. If slightly shorter. Okay, any comments? I heard you say something, but I couldn't tell what it was. You could, yeah. The advantage to writing out the choices here is that when you have all these parameters, you want to make sure that you've been careful about controlling which ones depend on which other ones. So the order in which these are chosen is somewhat important. But it is true that it is arbitrarily small, and it would be correct to say that. Other comments about this write-up, or how you might do it differently? Okay, let's see. Would it be helpful to look at that? That's a fairly complicated one. Would it be helpful to try one more write-up? Or should we another one that I had in mind was Spring 15, 2015 number 6 that we talked about a little bit yesterday. It's come up several times. I'll just bring it up and see if people are interested in seeing That one, we actually came up with most of it last time, so this will be fairly brief. It's on this page. Sorry, let me bring it up so you can see it. It's Spring 15, number 6 is the next one that I was thinking about. So it's one that actually, it was explained by you fairly clearly last time. So it's just a quick one to write up. Is it visible now? Sorry, yes, yeah, that's right. Yes, sorry, it was Gavin, thank you. Yeah, who explained it pretty clearly how this one goes. Let's see. So, would anyone find it helpful to just write down a complete solution to this one? It's almost copying what we did yesterday. Well, maybe I will do so since it's short, and then we can move on. So it's actually very similar to another problem that we saw in the exam that we looked at today, of course. And what the other one did was lead you through it, and this one doesn't. So you should basically do what the other one suggested, which is to start by just writing down the definition. So so recall the topologies of interest. So one, A, and converges weakly weak operator to A if and only if, and it's nice that you write it because you're going to use it for all x and y in your Hilbert space H. You have that the an x compared with y approaches as n goes to infinity the limiting operator ax plugged into the same situation. And then two, the other thing that you're interested in is when an converges in the strong operator norm to A, and this is if and only if for all x in H, we have that the norm of an x minus the norm, minus ax goes to zero. And by the way, this first one could also be rewritten, if you wish, as the pairing of a and x due to the linearity, your bilinearity, minus ax with y goes to zero. That's another way to say it. So that's what I do. I start by just writing down the definitions, and then just combine it as was suggested last time. So then the proof. Right. Oh, and actually, I guess I might even just label this fact here that we're given something, so that I can just refer to it. So then we have just exactly what was done last time. We're trying to check two, so for all x and h, which is what we're supposed to do, we have, and then we just compute the thing we're supposed to compute. And so this was the norm of an x minus ax, just as written above, squared this time, because that's what's easier, is equal to the pairing, of course, with itself. So anx minus ax paired with itself. And then I would just write out, like you did yesterday, what this comes out to. And I mean, I may not include all the terms, but it comes out to anx squared plus x, ax squared minus these two terms, anx ax. Minus, and now you can add a step. It's sort of a question of how many steps you want to add, but one thing I can do is I can just turn it around and get another copy of this, so anx, ax, and when I switch it around, I guess I get the complex conjugate. So this is one way to write out what we had yesterday. And, okay, and so then this is approaches. All right, and this is by zero for this for the first one, for the second one we're going to use one, and for the third one we're going to use one, and it's just going to be two minus two times anx squared, which is zero. Okay, so that's quite compact, but it does, so it wouldn't hurt to add a little bit more, but it does have the advantages, for example, that it's the reader can follow it because one is indicated what gets used, etc. Okay, so anyone have any thoughts about this? Okay, like I said, that's one that Gavin worked through last time. Okay. Yeah, so I'm not sure how helpful these are. As do since you're just kind of sitting there, but would people be interested in seeing another one of these or in trying some metric space problems? Maybe for some variety, we can move on to some problems. Okay, yeah, let's do some problems. All right, let's make sure we understand the upshot of this. So this says that it converges weakly to an operator, and you have this extra condition, right? So this extra condition is non-trivial, right? So that's Oh, I see what you're saying. Yeah, do we need the Hilbert structure for the target? Yes, I don't Yes, I think so. At least certainly the ways that I understand it, the generalization that I would imagine is where the target space is still Hilbert, and the domain I might switch to be Banach. Okay, other thoughts? Okay, so let's look at a few problems. I have some metric space problems here. Okay, so feel free to spend a few minutes looking at this, and if you have a thought or comment, either say it or use a little green thing or raise your hand or something so I know when people are ready to start looking at it. Okay, are people having any thoughts about this one? Okay. And this is directly? Does anyone have an idea of how you actually, I admit that on the original problem, it did suggest which theorem to use, but can anyone see which, guess at least, what theorem would give one a unique fixed point? Yeah, this is a contraction mapping theorem problem. Do people remember what that is, or should we write down the statement? Or maybe someone could just tell me the statement, then we'll have it. And by the way, Greg, yeah, the contraction mapping theorem is kind of tracking around exactly the sequence that you suggest, yes. But anyway, yeah, so could someone just tell me the statement of the theorem, contraction mapping theorem? It was kind of skipped. Oh, is that right? Interesting. What text did people use? I'm not sure who was teaching A, 201A. Well, all right. Let me state the theorem. Yeah, okay. And did he use his own notes, or was he following? Okay, they have a whole chapter on it. All right. Anyway, he skipped it. Okay. You didn't do that chapter. All right. Well, that's kind of there's not a lot of meat in the chapter, but anyway, it is a chapter. Let's just take the theorem. So if X is a yeah, it's closer to Lipschitz. That's right. It is. That's right. Complete metric space. That's exactly the right thing. So we have is a complete metric space. That's the right setting. Completes enough, and I think, yeah, and we have the T, our operator, mapping X to X, like you suggest, right, on itself, and it should have some sort of Lipschitz-like condition, and that's the contraction condition. So, and yeah, you don't need bounded. Right? It's enough. You have contraction. So that replaces the Lipschitz situation. And that is there exists some constant lambda between 0 and 1, which I guess they're calling k in this problem, which contracts. So whenever you have a pair of points in X, after you hit it with T, they're a factor of lambda closer. So the distance between t x and t y is smaller by this factor of lambda than the distance between x and y. Okay, so it's contracting. And those are the hypotheses. One reason is there's a unique fixed point. Okay. It's a good one to look up if you didn't cover it. Okay, so do people want to spend a moment now that we have the statement of the theorem, trying to figure out how to apply that to this one? Okay, interesting. Okay, yeah, why don't we see how you did that? Okay.
So we just set x naught to x bar.
Okay.
And then every turn after is just f of the previous one.
Okay, so xi is just f of xi minus 1?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. And then we can show that all of the xi's are in the ball in D.
Okay. So xi is in D for all i.
And so because it's complete, we can also show that it's Cauchy. So it's complete. So the limit is also going to be in D.
Okay. Oh yeah. Okay. So that's a comment to make. Is it that it is Cauchy?
So there's a limit.
Compute.
And then we can show that the distance is going to be, because of geometric series, is bounded by R, so it's going to be in D as well.
Oh, okay, all right, so let me try to understand correctly. So first you're going to show that you're going to compute that it's Cauchy, all right? And then once it's Cauchy, then you're going to say, since it's complete, it has a limit.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. And
And the max distance that it is from x bar is going to be r because of the constraint.
Okay, so the distance from x bar to this limit x is less than r, or less than equal to r.
Less than or equal to r. Yeah.
Thank you.
Uh-huh.
By,
so it has
by constraint. So it's in the ball. All right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then we can just show that f is a fixed point.
Okay, so x is our fixed point. So, and let's see here. Okay, and then we have to compute it that it's a fixed point? Let's see, how close are we? Oh, yeah, so you built this thing, which is the limit, and then you check that it's fixed. Okay.
Yeah, I haven't flushed out all the detail, but
That
should work. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you're right. Okay, very good. Let's see. I forget the name of the map. F is the name of the map. Okay, so f of x. is equal to x. And so that's existence, and as already pointed out, uniqueness you can also do without too much trouble, right? So this is existence. Okay, so let's see, I'm not sure if I'm following everyone here. Oh yeah, so someone has suggested how to prove that it's Cauchy. So this uses the triangle inequality. Okay, you got it to work, Greg? Okay, very good. All right, so you didn't. Okay. All right. So let's see. So which things are left to check? So I guess there's this Cauchiness, right? Whoops. There's this Cauchy property. The fact that this is fixed, is that straightforward? Let me just number them. So one, we have to check Cauchiness. Two, we have to check that this X that we built is invariant, and then three, I guess we have to show uniqueness. Okay, and where does our hypothesis come in? Did that get used somewhere?
That one is used to show that D of X bar with X is less than or equal to R.
Ah, okay, right.
By using a geometric sequence, a series.
Right, okay. Good, right. It's a good cross-check that our hypotheses got used. Okay. All right, very good. Do people want to make sure that they're following this completely for a second, or are we ready to move on? Or we could try writing it out in a little bit more detail. Okay, yeah, so let's just run through how these various things are proved, so that everyone's clear. So let's see, does everyone agree that the things I've numbered are exactly the things that have to be checked when you run through this argument?
For uniqueness, it's just a d of xy is equal to d of f of x, f of y is less than or equal to k times d of xy.
Okay. Sorry.
So x must equal to y.
Okay, so if f of x is equal to x and f of y is equal to y, then you're doing a computation, right? And sorry, I missed it because my hand wasn't working. So what was that again?
D of xy.
Okay.
Is equal to D of f of x, f of y.
Mm-hmm.
And we apply the criteria, which is less than or equal to k D of xy. And we know that k is between 0 and 1. So this doesn't work unless D of xy is 0.
Right. Okay, very good. So that's three. All right. And okay, let's see. So there's been some discussion about whether this lives in D. So are people happy with that? Or should we say a little bit more about why the limit lives in D? I guess I should have numbered that one, right? So that's one of the things that we have to check. Here's this number four here, right? That the limit does live in D. Right. So I guess the sequence is that you're going to do this computation by a geometric series, and then you're going to say that since this is the closed ball, it's then therefore in D. Okay, so then, so let's see if I'm following everything. So one, so some people said that you could use a triangle inequality. Other people said you could just compute this directly somehow.
Oh, in fact, for four, mm-hmm. because this is closed, we can just say each of the xi is in D, and that would be enough, and that would just be a finite series for each one of them.
Okay. Okay. Then use completeness. Right. Okay, and what about one and two straightforward? Okay, yeah, several people have mentioned something or other about how to do one, so maybe a triangle inequality. Okay, and then is two easy? Or is there some work to do there?
Since xi is equal to f of x sub I minus 1, we just apply limit.
For the for 2 here, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, so that seems like a pretty thorough outline for how this one goes. Any comments or questions about this one? Okay, let's look at another. So actually, just one comment on the previous one. What we just went through was almost the complete proof of the contraction mapping term, basically what we just did. I also skipped the closed graph theorem, okay. That's right. That's correct. That's correct. Okay. So this is a map. Okay, so then the claim is that F is continuous if and only capital F if and only if a little f. Okay. Great. Exactly right. Yep. This is a fact. You can write it as a theorem. So what? Let's see. And is one easy to show, or is there some work there? Right. This would be one direction. So this would be. Okay, so for the other direction. So assume we have a contradiction, xn converging to x. F of xn does not converge to f of x. Then you're claiming we immediately get that it's not closed. Okay, so I kind of like composing maps. So you're saying that another way to do this is to look at the projection to the second coordinate, and which is a continuous map. Right, so I guess, so the picture that I have, I just keep track of my picture here, we have Xn converging to this X. Okay, and then I have these values up here that don't converge necessarily to something, but there's a value which is f of X. Okay, and are we getting, I missed what we're getting out of this projection to the second coordinate, which is certainly a nice continuous map that we have access to. So notice, by the way, that it could be that the image of our map F, if it's not continuous, is closed but not compact, right? So that's that we'd have to worry about that issue. Oh, I see, I see. Okay, you're relating the continuity of I see. So you're working on number one here. Okay. So yeah, notice, of course, one example to keep in mind is that you could have something where the function goes off to infinity. So this is not continuous, and the image is not compact, but the image is closed. Okay, so that's... Yeah, that's right. Bounded is good. So note that right. So in both cases, right. So the graph is compact. Implies that the graph is bounded. Is that the direction you wanted? We also get that F continuous implies that the graph is bounded. Right? Both of those are true. Ah, okay. Right, that's a good point. So the Heine-Borel is a good term to have in mind. In R2 or RN in general, compact is equivalent to closed and bounded. Right. Okay, so we're getting close, so we have it here. Okay, so just to summarize where we are, I feel like we're kind of happy now with this direction, right? Continuous implies compact. I think. So then we're working on this second one. And we were trying to argue that the image is not closed, but or it's not bounded, right? So I guess we showed that if the graph is compact, then the graph is bounded. So if we can show that if the function's not continuous but bounded, then the image is not closed, then we'd be done, right? To understand the arguments we've got so far, we need that F is not continuous, but bounded. Then the image of F is not closed. Do people agree? My understanding of what's been said so far is that that's what's left to be shown. Does that sound correct? Right, I think that's right. So that given you, I think you've incorporated right in there the solution to this last little bit here, by noting that if you have this sequence which approaches X but whose images do not and it's bounded, then there's a subsequence that has some sort of limit point, and that limit point is what's preventing it from being closed. Correct. So you can find this subsequence that's approaching your Y, and then you're saying that Y is not in the image. Okay, so I feel like all the bits are here, and all that remains is to pull it all together into a tidy write-up. Is everyone happy with that? Okay, if so, let me move on to another problem. Yeah, okay, so there's an answer for one here. The A's are what should be distinct. No need for the X's to be distinct. No restriction on the X's. Yeah, exactly, as Milo says, that's correct. Okay, and will this same answer work for two? Yes. Right, now use one. Yeah, it's a bit of a trick, but if you think a little bit about the cardinality issue, since the cluster points are associated with subsets, the power set of the countables of a countable infinite cardinal is bigger than countable. Okay, yeah, so that's right. Basically, you just have to think of that trick, and then you're done. Any thoughts or comments about this one? All right. Okay, another. Okay. All right, so are you quoting that as a theorem or as a plan for how to prove this? Good. Yeah, good. So maybe just like in the problem that I wrote up earlier, where we were looking at various topologies, with the problem, I guess it really doesn't hurt just to start by writing down the definitions of everything. So did you want to, since you have these, tell us the definitions of these various things? So the definitions that we need so far are separable and second countable, right? Okay, someone, all right, so anyone, what's separable? So it should have a countable dense subset. And what's second countable? So this is not points, but open sets. Okay, so is anyone thinking of any approaches either to prove this separability directly or to use this one and two approach? Okay, so this is a proof that separable implies a second countable. All right. Yes. So we take rational radius metric balls. Right. Okay, and so the other direction, take a point from each of the base. Okay, so that's so that would be how to approach one. Okay, now is a second countable something that's easier to directly compute heritability than the property we started with? In other words, did we gain by moving here? So is this one clear? Two is actually easy, right? The work was in one. Yeah, just take the original base. Just take the base you had before, and that'll induce the same topology. Just intersect it with your subspace. Okay. Yeah, so that's certainly one approach. Did anyone else have any other thoughts, other approaches trying to actually build this sequence, this dense set directly? Because that's the other thing one could imagine trying to do. Okay, well, this certainly works, and not only does it work, but it even gives a prescription for how to build it directly, right? You could just follow this proof through, and it would end up giving you an actual sequence of points. You could do it that way. This certainly works. Any other thoughts or comments about this one? Okay, let me this one more then. Correct. So do people have a geometric understanding of what this metric space X comma D is? So I think once you have a picture for it, it's pretty clear how to do two. Yeah, okay. I guess that's one way to think about it. Okay. Anyway, yes, I agree with the answer that the open ball of radius 1 around 1, 0 is an example. So the ball of radius 1 around the point 1, 0 is an example. And there's a set, is it clear what this is? So if I have my plane here, the distance between two points is that. Yeah, that's right. So the ball that's being suggested here is the ball of radius 1 around that point, I guess. And as noted, it's just subset of the real line, right? So it's just this interval from 0 to 2. Which is not open in the Euclidean topology. So is the topology clear? So basically it's a bunch of lines which are joined at a point but otherwise don't see each other. So topologically they're just a whole bunch of lines. Uncountably many, but a whole bunch but they're metrically pretty different from each other. Okay. All right, let's see. So we have just a minute and a half. So what I was thinking to do for next time was to sort of look through the exams that we've looked at before and maybe one more and basically just try again. So look at them again now that we've done this and then maybe just to, you know, as we are going through them, we can add more detail to the ones that that we feel like. And if you like, in the last minute, I could just write a solution to fall of 2014 number one, this last one. I will say that the committee that year was a bit disappointed at how few people got this one. So let me just, since we only have a minute, let me just write down a solution. So I assume, and there are lots of ways to write this out, but here's mine. So you can do it various ways. So this is greater than or equal to 2, and then compute. But we've talked about this one to some length, so I'm going to compute f of a plus b minus f of a minus b, and I'm going to get that as an integral from a minus b to a plus b of the derivative. Okay, and I'm going to get that as an integral of the derivative of the derivative from a to x, right? And so then this I'm going to get, so then I'm just going to, plus the constant term, of course, plus f prime of a, which is the key, right? And then I'm going to get this as, and then I'm going to use my various bounds. So then this will be less than or equal to just integrate, just bounding and integrating. This is less than or equal to 4b minus b squared. And take b equals 2. So f of a plus 2 minus f of a minus 2 is greater than or equal to 4, which is a contradiction. Okay, so that's one way to do that, which is pretty quick. Okay, anyway, so out of time, and again, let me know if you have other thoughts or types of problems you're interested in, but I think if we just go through the old exams again, now that we've looked at a bunch of different types of problems, we can see if there are any that still look sort of unfamiliar, and once again, the strategy for these exams is to find ones that do look familiar, make sure you can do those, and don't plan to do all six, you know, just if you get four of them with good, clean answers, as you can see from the scores which are posted on the website here, it's that's you know, four good solid answers is going to do it for you. Okay, so I will see you tomorrow if there are no further comments.